So where are we going to start?
Where should we start?
Vegas?
Let's start in Vegas.
June 17th.
June 17th, 2017.
We're downtown, right on the strip at this outdoor stage. Thousands of people in the audience. And this group has just walked out to perform. Their name?
Mobb Deep is this hip-hop duo. It's these two guys, Prodigy and Havoc. They were huge in the 1990s. Okay, here we go. There's a war going on outside, no man's safe from. You can run, but you can't hide forever. You need streets that we done took. You walk with your head down, scared to fuck. You shook, cause ain't no such thing as halfway broke.
The other thing you need to know about Las Vegas right then is that it's hot, like over 100 degrees, even though the sun is setting and it's packed.
Prodigy and Havoc run through a couple of tracks. And then, as the mob, I think, almost always does, they cue their classic club destroying groundbreaking song Shook Ones Part 2. We gotta stop on some real shit. We need an infamous, you heard of us. Official queens, murderers. Far from a quick to warfare, beware. Crime family who got enough shots to share. In that heat, everyone's got their phone up. Prodigy and Havoc are rapping the songs, and they could turn their mics off and do the whole song. The crowd knew every syllable.
Like they supposed to.
They come around.
But they never come close to.
Nah. It's clear at the end of Shook Ones that they left it all on stage.
Oh, yeah.
Yo, one love, y'all.
So Prodigy walks off the stage, and he looks happy, but you can tell looking at him that he's tired. And that's a big deal, because he has sickle cell anemia. And the thing about sickle cell is that when you exert yourself the way Prodigy just did, get up on a stage in the baking heat, it can make you feel terrible. Normally, your blood cells are these flexible little discs. They can squeeze into capillaries. They can transform almost into like a liquid. But sickle cell makes your blood cells stiff. They cut off circulation to your bones and your organs. This is what makes sickle cell really painful. But for anyone who works with pee, all of this is kind of normal.
I wasn't like too alarmed. I was like, all right, okay, we got to go back to the hotel, because that's what we usually do. He'll, you know, he might get sick. We'll go to the hotel. He'll go to the room, you know. He'll, you know, take his meds or whatever and relax. And then the next morning, he's up and we're gone.
This is their DJ from that night. His name is Ski Beats. These guys have been working together for years.
So I say, yo, I'm rolling with y'all. You know, while I was in the car, P, you know, he was talking. He's like, oh, man, I don't feel good. I might have to go to the hospital today. But it's crazy because when you looked at him, you know, P always had that crazy smile, like, oh, man, I'm gonna have to go to the hospital. You know, I ain't feeling good. But he was kind of smiling, like, you know what I'm saying? So you couldn't really gauge how bad, you know, what was going on with him.
So they get back to the hotel, and everyone says their goodnights. They go back to their rooms, and that's it. Until a few days later.
Everybody's on the phone.
When P's friends around the country start getting these calls.
No fucking way possible. He's dead. He's on tour right now. They're doing the show. I refuse to believe this shit. What are y'all talking about? In the summertime, you know, you talking about this sunny day right here that we having right now. I'm in here making beats. Prodigy is dead right now. Sun is over. He gone.
Finding out if it was true.
Albert Johnson.
still can't believe it. I just still can't believe it.
I just want to say, rest in peace to Prodigy.
When Prodigy died in 2017, everyone was stunned. This was the death of a father, a brother, a great friend, a hip-hop legend.
But what we discovered was that P had had full-blown medical crises throughout his career, all over the world. Those days and weeks in the hospital, lying in bed, in pain, they not only changed P as a person, they changed his entire approach to hip-hop from the very beginning.
The first thing when I asked him, I said, yo, kid, why you want to do this for? The first thing he ever said, he said, because I got sickle cell anemia and I'm going to die. I don't know when, at any time it could happen, so let's get it.
Prodigy was a New York rapper. And just in case you think you don't know Prodigy, you know Prodigy.
He has influenced countless other artists. Kendrick Lamar, Eminem. He's been sampled by Mariah Carey and Lady Gaga.
We're going to tell you Prodigy's story, but we're also going to tell you the story of sickle cell. 100,000 Americans, mostly black folks, are living with this disease every day.
It's a story about race and institutional neglect. It's about who gets care in this country and why.
But listen, it's also about an MC, a guy from Long Island, New York, whose influence is still felt today. To really get Prodigy's music, you gotta understand his life with sickle cell. Both of those things together.
I'm Mary Harris.
And I'm Christopher Johnson. This is a special three-night broadcast of The Realness, a look at Prodigy's struggle with sickle cell anemia and how it shaped his life and his music.
Life before hip hop was just pain. Like sickle cell was my life before hip hop. You know what I mean? I ain't really have no life. That was it. You know, I'm growing up and just that's all I knew was just being in a fucking hospital all the time. And then music, you know, the aggressiveness of it just attracted me to hip hop because I was angry inside. I was an angry kid because of the sickle cell and so I liked the anger in hip hop. So that's what attracted me to it. That's what made me want to do it. It helped me get my aggression out.
So just a few months before he died, Prodigy went on Questlove's Supreme podcast.
They call me P.
Yeah.
H-N-I-C.
Yeah.
He told this one story about how he came up in the rap world.
It goes back to high school, a place in Manhattan called Art and Design.
My first year of high school, in my photography class, was a kid named Black from the Bronx. And we got real cool, kicking it every day in class.
And one day Black says to him, like, I want you to meet my friend.
He was like, yo, man, y'all both rap, y'all both about the same height. You know, I'm going to introduce you to him after school.
It was this guy who everyone called Kiwi.
So little did I know that these niggas were setting me up to rob me. I used to wear mad jewelry. Like, I used to have, I thought I was Slick Rick, dog. I used to have hands full of rings, mad chains.
Prodigy actually talks about getting robbed and being scared of being robbed a lot as a kid. He even started carrying a gun to school to protect himself. But still, he didn't suspect a thing.
I was like, I'm cool with Black. We cool. King, he seemed like a cool dude. He was like, yo, y'all should make a group. I'm going to introduce you to him after school. I'm like, all right, bet.
So Prodigy and Black, they walk outside to meet this kid, Kiwi.
And there's a fight right in front of the school. So I'm like, we looking at the fight.
It's these two kids, and one of them pulls out a knife, and he slashes at the other kid, but he misses.
Missed him. Hit his, like, leather jacket.
And they realize the kid who almost just got stabbed, it's Kiwi.
And that kid with the knife, Kiwi starts whooping his behind.
And the crowd, like, flips out. The way Prodigy tells it, they actually lift Kiwi up in the air and they carry him.
I swear to God, all the way to the train station after the fight.
Wait, you can't. We can't just go past that.
Do you think that actually happened?
I mean, P's telling of it is that they lift him on his shoulder like he won the game.
Yeah, like score the winning touchdown, like, woo!
So, you know, we following him to the train station. I'm like, this is crazy. Like, all right. So after they put him down, we get on the train. We meet each other. So I'm like, yo, where we going? He's like, we're going to Ravenswood.
This is the Ravenswood Housing Projects out in Queens.
I'm like, Ravenswood? I'm like, my grandmother from Ravenswood. He was like, a word? He's like, my grandmother from Ravenswood.
Nowadays, this guy Kiwi, he goes by Havoc.
And it's kind of crazy. This is the dude that was supposed to rob Prodigy. And they end up as these lifelong creative partners, rocking crowds all over the planet and making gold and platinum albums. This was that dude.
That was it. We just got cool that day. You know what I'm saying? And we started making songs immediately. We just clicked. You know what I mean? We became really close friends and getting into mad trouble together.
This is where Mobb Deep started. On a train into Queens after school one day.
I mean, we made like 50 songs immediately. We just started pushing forward with it. Like, this is, we got something.
The way these two kids decided to go get a record deal.
What we used to do is look on the back of albums. All right, here's the address. All right, come on, let's cut out of school. Let's take the train. Go down.
And they would stand in front of record label offices in Soho, the East Village.
And with the headphones, Walkman, and we should just stand outside the door like this and wait for the rappers to come out, you know what I mean, or whoever to come out. And we seen, you know, a bunch of different rappers come out. We should be like, yo, listen to our demo tape.
And,
like,
and this worked. They got a record deal when they were still teenagers.
I don't know. They had, I guess they were about 13, 14 maybe at the time, and two little kids from Queensbridge.
Scott Jacobs is a producer who worked with Mobb Deep back in the day. And he's probably got their ages wrong, but this just shows how young they looked.
I always remember Key's little line talking about something about baby Slick Rick, little Rick the ruler, and in my pocket there's a fat bag of Buddha. You know what I mean? It's like my first instinct is like, what are these 13-year-old kids doing talking about bags of Buddha? You know what I'm saying?
So in 1993, the Mobb releases their first album. They call it Juvenile Hell.
Some pretty big name producers made the music for this album, and Prodigy and Havoc, they got a nice chunk of change to make it.
You know, that was the big deal back then, getting a major budget and blowing your budget. You know, I remember Prodigy pushing like a Sterling, could barely see over the wheel back in the days. And it had like big cables that weighed more than them. And I mean, but with that said, they had some of the illest cats around them helping them develop that record.
So then they set out to actually try to sell this album.
You know what I mean? Then we go off on a little promo run. We doing an in-store one day in D.C.,
they go to a record shop. Remember record shops?
And we walk into the in-store.
And all of a sudden, over the loudspeakers, comes this really lovely jazz piano riff.
It's yours. Whose world is this? The world is yours. The world.
The song is called The World Is Yours. And the way the MC comes on the mic, boy, it's just fire.
I sip the dumb peak, watching Gandhi till I'm charged and writing in my book of rhymes, all the words past the margin. The whole of mic, I'm throbbing, mechanical movement, understandable smooth that murderers move with.
And Prodigy and Havoc actually know this guy.
His name is Nasir Jones, but at this point, everyone's just calling him Nas.
Illmatic is playing. We never heard it before.
And at that moment, Prodigy says they had this realization.
We're like, oh, we went about this all wrong. You know what I'm saying? And that brought us down to reality, basically.
And they realized that what Nas was doing, that was the kind of stuff that they wanted to be doing. They didn't want to just get your head to nod. They wanted to make timeless rap songs. And Juvenile Hell was not that.
You know what I'm saying? Because we could hear the difference. We could hear it. It was a big difference between the, you know, the thought that was put into making, writing the lyrics, making the beats. He put some serious thought into that, and we didn't. We were just feeling ourselves, yeah, we got a rap deal. Yeah, I got gold tooth. Yeah, like, you know what I'm saying?
Mobb Deep's album, it only sold about 20,000 copies.
our arrogant attitude, that's why that album came out like and underperformed, and it was like not really, we didn't put our heart and soul, we didn't understand that this is not a joke. Like, you can't just do whatever and people supposed to kiss your ass and like it. You gotta make timeless, you gotta make some shit that stand the test of time. And we didn't understand that. We was very arrogant, we was very, you know, cocky on some bullshit.
And not long after that, Prodigy and Havoc got dropped by their record label.
Yo, our hearts was broken. You know what I'm saying? Because we was like, yo, this is what we want to do with our life. So we was like, hold on. No. We got to show people who we are. We got to tell our story the right way. We got to put, like I said, put thought and put meaning, put your soul, put your heart into the music. Like, you know what I mean? Tell your story, man. Like, you know what I'm saying? And we had the attitude, like, you know, this ain't going to happen again. You know what I'm saying? 1,000% for sure, this is never going to happen again. You know what I'm saying?
They decided to start over.
You know what I'm saying?
And what they came up with, man, this album, The Infamous, that record would help define a generation of hip-hop in the mid-90s.
You must be crazy, kid, man, I never did. Forever wild, and that's how I live. Up in the bridge, you just sit scared. Cop back, the cat that hit a nigga like a bitch. 25, nah, kid, you get...
It's a total 180 from what they were doing before.
It's slowed down. It sounds composed. It's gorgeous. It's Mobb Deep's second album, but a lot of people think of it as their first one.
Including Prodigy.
Yeah, Prodigy sometimes just refers to it as their first album.
But the music on The Infamous, man, even today, nothing sounds like The Infamous. I'm in this, the witness, you're gonna take a fall. The Infamous,
Queensbridge, we on the scene, kid, creeping. They changed, they made the music dark. When I hear their beats, I say, damn, the light went out. What happened? Oh, my God. It just became dark and, like, really gritty. And it was like, yo, I want to hear this. And
this is one of the first hosts of a show called Yo MTV Raps Today. This is Dr. Dre.
Also known as AKA Wonka Dre, also known as Big Daddy Original Concept Dre, also known as, I don't have all those AKAs. I'm just joking.
Dre says, yeah, the music was dark, but, man, it was also electric. And when this stuff played in the club, it just made people feel some kind of way. As time goes by, and I for an eye, we in this together, son, your beef is mine. So long as the sun shines to light up the sky,
we in this together, son, your beef is mine. As time goes by. Oh, man, you want to start beating and fighting your boy and grabbing and jumping around. Yo, listen, this is that thing, yo. And women started feeling themselves. You started going, yo. It was a different thing. Start from the beginning
at the top. Other rappers were having fun with their music.
But Havoc and Prodigy, they had vocals where it was almost like they turned the light out of the room and you were like, yo, I want to hear this. And the smoke started filling up around you. That was the vibe. You guys like, yo, this is something dope. This is Mobb Deep. If I'm out of town, one of my crew will take care of you. The world is ours and your team's inferior. You want to bust caps, I get all up in your area. Kidnapping children make the situation scarier.
And when you compare The Infamous with their first record, part of what changed their sound was Sickle Cell.
The big thing about Juvenile Hell is, production-wise, Prodigy was more the producer.
This is Scott Jacobs again. He says Prodigy's disease flipped the roles that P and Hav had in the group. When they started out, Hav was doing a lot of the writing.
So Havoc was doing a little ghostwriting for P, yo, you know. Say it like this, say it like that, whatever. Go back, listen to Prodigy's flow. It's very animated. It's very excited. And that's basically Havoc.
Now, when they were making The Infamous, Prodigy was getting sick, the same way he always did.
So what happens is Havoc is home, right? But any background for any kind of thoughts or ideas always stem from the music first.
Prodigy is having to go to the hospital for hardcore pain relief. He's doped up. He's on morphine.
So what's Havoc supposed to do? Wait for P to get home in order to start writing? So Havoc starts to learn how to program the machines. And Prodigy, who's spending most of his time on his back, right, starts writing more.
And Scott Jacobs tells a story about asking P about, hey, why'd you change your flow? Why'd you change your style?
He was like, yo, I was just laying in the hospital, man. You know, I was all numbed up. And, you know, I was like, rather than get all excited or whatever, he said, I'm going to just talk to these niggas. And that's going to be my style.
So this is where it happens. That ill, slowed down, plain spoken flow. That style, Prodigy style, that hip hop fans know even when he's sampled on other people's music. It came from Sickle Cell, and you can hear it all over the Infamous album.
Yo, it's the P, E double, pushing legs bubble in the winter. You can't come along, only the hoes can enter. Told her meet me at 6 on the hill at the center. Took her to the west way and bent her right over. Stay intoxicated, never sober. Faced it, violating, get laced it. Why you wasting? Slugs, you ain't bucking nothing. You better off bucking yourself. You need to stop fronting.
The Infamous sold 500,000 copies in just 2 months. The mob toured Europe and the whole U.S., both coasts.
But when Prodigy was born, kids like him, kids with sickle cell, they weren't supposed to be stars. They weren't even supposed to make it past 20.
But then doctors and activists took this obscure, misunderstood disease, and they made it so urgent, even the president had to pay attention.
America has long been the wealthiest nation in the world. Now it is time we became the healthiest nation in the world.
We'll be right back after the break.
The doctor always told me all my life, you got sickle cell. There's nothing you can do about it. You're not going to live past 40. That's it. I never thought, like, I'm going to die when I'm 40, because that's what they said. But definitely the pain that I was going through made me off a little bit. You know what I'm saying?
We've told you about Prodigy's rise to rap stardom, how he and his bandmate Havoc got together in high school, how they started making music, how they fell flat on their faces, and then how they reinvented themselves. And all along the way, there was also Prodigy as a young man battling sickle cell. And to get into that part of his life, we've actually got to leave Prodigy for a minute and go back to a period in time when a group of doctors and black radicals and even Hollywood stars took a misunderstood disease and turned it into one of the most urgent social and political issues of their era.
Welcome to the Mike Dickus Show.
And that history starts in the 1970s with one of the most popular daytime TV programs. It was called The Mike Douglas Show.
And now, here's Mike.
It was hosted by an ex-big band and nightclub singer, and he'd have all kinds of celebrities on stage with him.
That was pretty good, wasn't it, huh? How about my band, Joe Harnell and the band?
This Mike Douglas show, which was filmed in Philadelphia, was watched by millions of people every day.
Alondra Nelson is a sociology professor at Columbia University, and she's actually written about one specific episode in February 1972.
And this particular week, it would have been watched quite a lot because it was guest hosted by John Lennon and Yoko Ono.
John Lennon and Yoko Ono!
Hello, 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 is the mic on?
On this show, they've got Vivian Reed, the actress. They've got this sketch comedy group called the Ace Trucking Company.
Car, where do you think you're going?
I'm driving a movie with Betty Sue.
The one who was out here last Saturday?
Yeah.
Hey, she's all right.
And in the midst of all that, John and Yoko and Mike Douglas, they turned to something really serious.
There's a disease in our society today that is a major concern, sickle cell anemia, and it affects a special segment of the society. Here is a young man who is a medical student and is working on being a leading authority in the field. Meet Donald Williams.
Donald Williams had been working with the Black Panther Party. He'd been helping them test people for sickle cell in the Oakland, California area. And when he walks out on stage, he's wearing a suit and he's carrying a black briefcase full of his medical books.
Yes.
You really came prepared.
Well, I'm primarily a student and I have to keep my books with me.
I see.
What is his study?
So he settles into his chair and jumps right into this really thorough, detailed explanation of what sickle cell anemia is.
Sickle cell anemia is a disease of the blood. It's an inherited disorder. It's the only way it can be contracted, or it cannot be contracted. The only way it can be gotten is through heredity, okay? It occurs primarily in blacks. It occurs in some Jewish populations. It occurs in some Turks.
And Mike Douglas, you can tell he is struggling to keep it entertaining.
The trait occurs when the person has only inherited one gene from one parent for production of hemoglobin S, which is the abnormal hemoglobin in sickle cell.
Okay. Boy, you fellas with those medical terms, you really, really go.
Talking about sickle cell anemia is not good television. It's not sexy, it's not interesting, and it was clear, certainly a few minutes in, that Mike Douglas is a little bit uncomfortable because he's a TV man and he knows this is not good TV.
What is your goal?
Our goal is to educate the entire black population in this country about sickle cell, what having the trait means, how it's passed on, how a kid gets the disease.
So you can prevent it in a way.
You can prevent it only if you prevent people with the trait from having kids.
From falling in love, right?
Yeah, very sure. That's
this interview is important because it's one of the best examples we have of this pivotal moment in the 1970s when sickle cell became part of the national conversation.
It had come a long way since the disease was first discovered in the West in 1904. That's when a doctor who was looking at some blood under a microscope sees these, quote, peculiar and elongated red blood cells.
And what he theorizes is that this isn't just some kind of anomaly. It's an actual new disease.
This is Keith Wailu. He's a history professor at Princeton.
It's really from the 1910s through the 20s and 30s that clinicians start to identify these sickle-shaped red blood cells as being linked to particular kinds of painful episodes and painful crises, and then early childhood mortality.
A lot of physicians might not have been putting a kid's blood under the microscope. So when they saw kids with sickle cell come in, they might not have even known it was one condition. They would see kids coming in with pneumonia and meningitis because sickle cell wrecks your immune system.
There's also something called hand-foot syndrome. And basically, it makes babies' fingers and toes swell up, and it hurts so bad that sometimes babies will suck on their fingers and toes just to make them feel better. It's a really common symptom of sickle cell, but back in those early days, doctors may not have really known that. Researchers were just starting to figure out how this disease worked inch by inch.
And then in comes somebody like Linus Pauling.
After some years, at the end of the war, I learned about the disease sickle cell anemia.
Linus Pauling won the Nobel Prize twice. He's a chemist. He's often considered one of the founders of molecular biology.
And what Linus Pauling and his team of researchers theorize is that there can be such a thing as a disease that's caused by a molecule.
Immediately I thought, could it be possible that this disease, which seems to be a disease of the red cell because the red cells in the patients are twisted out of shape, could really be a disease of the hemoglobin molecule?
The hemoglobin molecule is a part of the red blood cell, and it moves oxygen all over the body.
Pauling saw this glitch in hemoglobin. It made the blood cells change shape from round to more of a crescent or a sickle.
And those sickled cells, they don't move through the body as smoothly as round cells. Instead, they stack up in a way that blocks the flow of blood and oxygen.
Nobody had ever suggested that there could be molecular diseases before, but this idea popped into my head.
Pauling's discovery was pretty incredible.
What it said is, we need to think about diseases as maybe happening at the level of small molecular dynamics rather than at the level of infections and viruses or bacteria.
But there was also a big problem with scientists like Pauling. It was all in the way they talked about sickle cell patients.
I believe first that heterozygotes should be identified.
Heterozygotes is the term Pauling used to describe people who had the sickle cell trait who might pass it on to their kids. And he had some thoughts on how to stop the spread of this disease. And honestly, they're horrifying.
If two heterozygotes marry one another, they should have no children, in my opinion.
In a fairly kind of naive comment, he says, well, maybe we can find a way to tattoo on the forehead people who have the sickle cell gene, and you put a tattoo on another person's forehead who's also a carrier. And then he argues that they see each other, and they see that each of them carries this gene. And maybe they will avoid falling in love with each other. That is to say that they themselves will recognize the danger.
If they want to marry one another, they should probably be sterilized so as to be sure that they would have no children.
He was just trying to think through, how do you actually solve this problem, knowing what we know about the mechanisms of inheritance? But this is a good example of how sometimes scientists can be callous because they are narrow.
This kind of scientific approach, this cool, callous theorizing, this wasn't going to be enough to save lives. That was going to take a different kind of fight in the communities where sickle cell was being lived and treated. That would have to be a fight advocating for people.
Sickle cell disease sees a very gradual two-decade transformation as a high-profile cultural phenomenon.
It started in the 1950s with the civil rights movement.
And then there's a real turning point in the late 1960s with the Black Panthers, who essentially argue that not only is this our disease, not only is this a statement about what it means to be Black, but we need to determine our own future by spreading information about it, by educating ourselves for it, and by raising funds to actually support the health and well-being of our children.
And to do that, the Panthers created a sickle cell screening program. It was nationwide, it was the first of its kind, and they would test people everywhere, at churches, clinics, community education rallies.
I'm sure we tested over 4,500 people for sickle cell anemia last night.
Party Chairman Bobby Seale helped lead the charge.
And I think that the voter registration is running neck and neck with it.
So it really becomes part of that broader dynamic that's very much part of the late 1960s rise of Black power.
The Panthers made the problem of this one disease, sickle cell anemia, about something much bigger. They made it about the exclusion of Black people from mainstream medicine.
And moreover, about their concerns for how healthcare and the neglect of healthcare is a way of doing harm to Black communities, right? Not only is it, a kind of benign neglect, they accused it of being a kind of genocide.
The Panthers also wanted people with the disease to understand that they were entitled to the best care.
That they deserved research into their disease, that they deserved scientists, our best scientists, putting their efforts into trying to uncover, or to discover a cure for the disease. And so they really helped to change a national conversation about the disease.
And the Panthers didn't do it alone. There was a groundswell in the 60s and 70s that turned a spotlight on the sickle cell. Major athletes and actors were talking about their own struggles with the disease. There were TV shows about it. There were movies about it. In 1973, Sidney Poitier starred in a romance where he falls in love with an African princess who has sickle cell.
Matt Younger came to London to see the sights. Then he caught sight of Catherine.
Wow, she's fantastic.
Catherine, elusive and beautiful. A Warm December, starring Sidney Poitier and Esther Anderson on the CBS Friday.
Black folks were taking ownership of this disease, the same way that a lot of communities did in the 80s with HIV and AIDS, to own the disease and to own the people who are going through it and to protect them as ours.
Brothers and sisters, peoples and human beings alike, it's good to see you here tonight. We're running a kind of revolution that involves our very lives, and it involves us building what we call people's power, starting in the heart of the Black community to the Chicano community.
And then the next step was to get that critical mass of understanding and put pressure for change on people who actually were in positions of power.
Presenting to you the President of the United States.
In his 1971 State of the Union address,
my fellow Americans,
President Nixon had been talking about overhauling the nation's health care system.
I will offer a far-reaching set of proposals for improving America's health care and making it available more fairly to more people.
He was even talking about universal coverage.
America has long been the wealthiest nation in the world. Now it is time we became the healthiest nation in the world.
It's not like sickle cell was on Nixon's agenda. His inner circle didn't really understand what the disease was about. But because of all this social and political pressure, it was clear he had to do something. So a year after that speech, he signed the Sickle Cell Control Act into law.
It dedicated $155 million to the research and treatment of this disease. It also created a whole network of sickle cell care centers all over the country.
The Panthers and others, they saw this as a pretty cynical ploy by a president who otherwise wasn't doing a lot for their neighborhoods.
One thing you might say is that that Nixon strategy was an attempt to co-opt the narrative of Black activists like the Black Panther Party about the state neglect of African-American communities, right? So this then becomes a way to say, no, we're actually not neglecting your communities.
This is where things stood when Prodigy was a baby in the mid-1970s.
Payne and I got real close in those early years. Ever since I was born, I was at the hospital at least 4 to 6 times a year with sickle cell. Every year. Sometimes for a week. Sometimes even up to a month.
The person who saw all of this up close was Prodigy's big brother, Greg Collins.
That was my buddy, man. He was, you know, I took to him right away because, you know, I never had a sibling. You know, you got guys that had older brothers, you know, and you wanted to be an older brother.
He's 13 years older, so he has some really vivid memories of Prodigy as a baby. What did y'all call him when he was born, first of all?
Well,
not Prodigy, of course.
No, of course not. His father's name was Albert Jackson Johnson III. I think it was the third. Anyway, so when they were naming my brother, my mother said, oh, no, we're not naming him no Albert Johnson. She wanted to name him T'Chaka. They kind of, I guess, worked together. They came to a middle ground and said, well, we'll name him that, but we can put T'Chaka, you know, in there. But we used to call him Chalk. Chaka, you know, Chalky, you know, that's what he was called. You know, nobody ever called him Bud or Albert. He was Chaka, you know, T'Chaka, and we called him Chaka for short. Yeah. I used to always try to do things with him because I wanted that interaction as my only brother, my only sibling, my only brother. Yeah, I always tried to take him with me wherever I went, you know, when he could. Because of his condition, though, I didn't get to do that a lot because I had to be very careful. The pain just seemed so excruciating, like you're wondering, I couldn't feel pain like that. Watching him and his pain going through what he was going through and just those movements, I couldn't feel that, man, but I felt it. I couldn't feel it, but I felt it.
Now, when I asked Greg if he could remember any of the doctors that had taken care of his brother, he's thinking and he's thinking and he says, God, there were so many. And then he lands on someone.
Dr. Francis was one of them, a female doctor, worked out of Queens, I think in like the St. Albans area.
Dr. Francis, Dr. Yvette Francis McBarnett. She helped advise President Nixon on his sickle cell policy. And as a pediatrician, she was instrumental in making sure Prodigy made it out of childhood.
Dr. Francis had her own sickle cell clinic in a house on Farmers Boulevard in Jamaica, where I hated going because it meant I was getting a penicillin shot in my butt. One of her remedies.
Dr. Francis ran a clinic where she pioneered the treatment of this disease. She began practicing in the 1950s when mortality for kids with sickle cell still hung around 10 years old.
And when Dr. Francis looked at kids like Prodigy, what she saw was that they kept getting those infections, and that would cause them to get really sick, sometimes even die. the primary thing that goes wrong with sickle cell, your blood cells getting stuck in your vessels, has this effect on your immune system. It actually blocks off your spleen, which means that when you get sick, you get really sick. When you get a cold, it can easily become pneumonia. And so she and other doctors like her start thinking, how can we prevent infections in these kids? And the way they did that was by giving these kids antibiotics, shots of penicillin. And it seemed to work.
Remember that it was uncommon for those with sickle cell to live past their teenage years when mom started medicine. And she was helping kids who it wasn't clear if they would survive.
Dr. Francis died in 2016, but her daughter, Ellen McBarnett, she actually worked at the clinic.
And she was doing her best, and she didn't know when she first started helping kids survive past 20, if they would survive to 25, would they survive to 30? This is groundbreaking.
Dr. Francis started using antibiotics in this way 15 years before the wider medical community acknowledged just how effective it is. And largely because of this treatment, Prodigy is among the first generation of kids born with sickle cell who, it's almost like this sidewalk gets extended out in front of them very slowly. And if you look at a graph that charts life expectancy for people with sickle cell anemia over the past century, the line on that graph spikes right around the early 1970s. This is right around the time that Prodigy was born.
I think our favorite game was tag in the dark. Someone's it, you choose who's it.
Carrie Edge grew up with Prodigy. They met because when she was still a toddler, she started taking dance classes at his grandmother's dance studio. And just like his brother Greg, she calls him Chalk.
Every Saturday, pretty much, he was there. Well, hanging around, getting into trouble.
What do you remember about Chalk?
He was quiet, funny, a real boy's boy, you know. Very mischievous, like Spider-Man.
Carrie and her mom were part of this extended family that took care of Prodigy when he was little. They'd go to the hospital when he was there. They'd take shifts and watch over him.
I learned very early that he was not to be alone.
Tell me about that.
Chuck can't be alone. I mean, he could be alone, but he can't be, like, completely alone. It has to, you know, is...
Why not?
Because something could happen at any moment.
Did you see him have an episode as a kid?
Mm-hmm. It had to have been excruciating pain. I've never seen anyone scream like that, ever. He appeared to know that it was going to be painful and that there was nothing that he could do but take the pain. He couldn't stay quiet. I felt like I was supposed to stop it and didn't really know how, other than to just go get an adult.
As a kid, Prodigy kept going in and out of the hospital. All that began to take a toll on him.
Around the time he was 12, he was getting fed up with it. And he also started removing himself more. And I noticed that he became less friendly. He was never rude to me, but I could see him being rude and short with people. And my conversations with him didn't include so much laughter anymore.
Growing up with sickle cell, you know, it was kind of different for me, man. It made me real angry at God, you know, for making me go through that pain. I was a young kid. I didn't understand why I was going through that. And I wanted to kill myself. You know what I'm saying? I didn't even want to live anymore because I was tired of that pain. It's like so painful. I was like 12 years old and I wanted to kill myself. My mother came in my room. And she saw me in the closet trying to cut my wrist with a steak knife, you know what I mean?
But at the same time Prodigy was going through all of this, at the same time he was feeling like he just couldn't live with this pain, he was also discovering hip-hop. LL Cool J's Rock the Bells.
LL Cool J is hard as hell. Battle anybody, I don't care, you tell. I excel, they all fail. Gonna cocktail, double L, must rock my bells.
Run DMC's classic track, Sucka MC's.
2 years ago, a friend of mine asked me to say some MC rhyme. So I said this rhyme I'm about to say. The rhyme was there, but then it went this way. Took a test to become an MC. And Orange Crit became amazed at me. So Larry,
when I heard those songs, that just changed everything in my life. I used to play the songs for my mother. Like, yo, mom, check this out. Matter of fact, I used to say Rakim's rhymes to my mom and act like I wrote it.
In the door, I said it before. I never let the mic magnetize me no more. But it's biting me, fighting me, inviting me to rhyme. I can't hold it back. I'm looking for the line, taking off my coat, clearing my throat. The rhyme will be kicking it till I hit my last note. My mind remains a fine.
Rap music spoke to the anger he says he felt because of his condition, and all the fire and the aggressiveness of the music. Prodigy loved it.
I was like, all right, this is what I want to do. It was just a vibe. You could just feel it. You know what I mean? You could feel. This is what it's supposed to be.
He says hip-hop saved his life.
But even as a rising rap star, when Prodigy went on the road, Sickle Cell was always there.
That's next on The Realness. We wanted to get a better sense of how Prodigy dealt with his sickle cell while he was becoming this rap legend. We reached out to Havoc, Prodigy's rap partner in Mobb Deep for so many years. No luck. But there are other people who were just as close to P back then.
Yo, this is Big Twins, Queensbridge Finest, Infamous Mob Crew.
Twins was a part of this huge crew of guys that would roll with Prodigy and Havoc wherever they went.
When did you first meet Prodigy?
When I was like 14 years old. We was over there by Havoc's grandmother crib in Ravenswood, and Havoc and P just walked up.
Twins grew up down the block from Havoc.
When he said, yo, we're going to start this new group called Mobb Deep. And I was like, why is Mobb Deep? He was like, because we're going to go to the club deep. It was over after that.
Twins and Havoc lived in Queensbridge Houses. This is the biggest public housing complex in the country. It was pretty rough when they were growing up, but it was also a source of mad inspiration. Queensbridge is almost like a character in Mobb Deep's music. And Prodigy, who was actually from Long Island, a lot of people assume he's from the bridge, too.
For me, I thought it was kind of weird because he had a nice crib in Long Island, you know what I mean? But he didn't want to be there. He kind of wanted to be in Queensbridge every day. So he used to be in my mom's crib, sleeping at my mom's crib all day. That's where he used to be at all day. He just like, yo.
That Queensbridge love, you could hear it in the music, but you could also hear it in the fact that the mob brought people like Twins up with them.
It was perfect. I used to have the whole hood in the studio, you know, just to give that energy. And when we went to the club, I'm like, when we go to the club, they get a limo, and I say, I'll meet y'all there. So I get on the train, I go to the hood, come on. 35 of us, we all take a train, and then have a P and meet us at the front door and get us all in. You know what I mean? That's how I used to do it. Well, I was trying to make the image.
So Twins was at the studio. He went on tour with Mobb Deep.
Super fun. You know, we go to the club and perform, bag some shorties, bring them back to the hotel, do what we do. You know what I mean?
When did you realize P had sickle cell?
That's crazy, because I didn't know for a while. I didn't even know what sickle cell was. I never even heard of that. Seeing the pain he was in, that was crazy, yo.
Do you remember what it looked like? I've actually never seen someone.
Man, I was in North Carolina, Mobb Deep and Fat Joe and Big Pun, and P had, me and him was sharing a room, and he had, man. P was saying he was not feeling so well. You know what I mean? Because I had brought a girl back to the room, and I'm messing with her, but he's in, like kind of sleeping, you know what I mean?
So they go to bed.
The next morning when we wake up, like he's breathing hard, and you know what I mean? I'm like, you good?
And he says, I need my medication. I need my medicine. Please get my medicine.
And that was my first time seeing morphine. I never seen it. The pill is like, it's nothing. It's like a grain of salt. Like, you know what I mean? It's so strong, too. So he took that. And he said, let me see how long it takes, you know what I mean? And then I left out.
When he comes back, Prodigy's even worse.
Full fresh. He was like sitting in the chair like this. Yo, call the ambulance.
So he's like panting?
Yeah.
He's
like, you know what I mean? He's rocking in the chair like this. And he like.
And he says, I need you to call an ambulance. You've got to call an ambulance for me.
But the ambulance took a while, so that's when we started talking.
He just sort of sits with him and he says, listen, I know this isn't the time to ask you.
I even said, my bad, I don't want to ask you, but how it feel, son? And he was like, it feel like my bones are burning. I was like, burning? He's like, yeah, it feel like my bones is on fire. I was like, that's what sickle cell feel like?
He said, I think all of Prodigy's friends had this moment with him where they asked, like, what does this feel like?
Nobody never seen P get sick like that, to that level, but the family, you know what I mean?
So eventually, the ambulance gets there, and all the other people they're on tour with start coming out of their rooms to see what's going on.
Everybody start coming in the hallway. Because he's like, what's going on? And then Big Pun came in the room and Fat Joe, and they seen it. They couldn't believe it. They could not believe the pain he was in.
He is screaming in pain, but he has no way to get to the ambulance. He can't move.
I just seen them crying. They just start crying immediately.
So Prodigy's boys get information around him, and they pick him up in his chair, and they carry him out to the ambulance.
And punning, and when they want to talk for hours after that, how he live like that, huh? You know what I mean? I was like, I'm kind of new to it too, you know what I'm saying? I never knew nothing about it either.
How did that change the way you saw P or thought about him or thought about his life?
Oh, nobody can get near him. You already know, we in the club, we in front, he behind us. Nobody can get nowhere near him. That's how I always was.
These guys were already really loyal to each other. They rolled Mobb Deep for a reason. Strength in numbers, to protect each other. They live by this code. Mobb Deep had a song called Eye for an Eye. We're in this together, son. Your beef is mine. So now Twins sees one of his closest friends go through this attack. And he decides he's going to protect Prodigy.
Once I knew he was sick, then it was another level holding him down. You know what I mean? Nobody can't get near him. Watching everybody, because we think something could happen to him if he get hit hard or knocked out, or you know what I mean? Because it's, the sickle cell, we don't know how crazy it is. So we really treated him different after that.
One of these guys from the mob told me, we protected him like he was the president. And I feel like that was because they loved him, but also because they'd seen this tremendous vulnerability in him. P couldn't help it. This was his life. And I think these guys took that really seriously.
I hate that sickle cell. So I hate it, man.
Next time on The Realness, Prodigy wasn't just born at a pivotal moment in the history of sickle cell. Mobb Deep came of age during one of the most electric moments in rap music. We take you inside the golden age of hip-hop and one of New York City's most epic nightclubs.
There were little little compartmental rooms. You would find a new one every time you went to this damn club. And these rooms used to have going on, and every inch of that club, it was a party.
This is the first of a 3-night special broadcast of The Realness. If you're enjoying what we're up to, head over to therealness.org for the whole series. Find out what happened when Prodigy's sickle cell collided with the criminal justice system and why his life was cut short. The Realness is a production of WNYC Studios, hosted by me, Mary Harris, and Christopher Johnson.
Our editor is Christopher Wirth. We had help from consulting producer Kathy Yandley and associate producer Aaron Mathewson.
Jared Paul is our engineer. Casey Means is our technical director. WNYC's vice president of news is Jim Schachter.
Trumpeter Christian Scott wrote our theme song and composed a lot of the music in this series. Additional music by Melanie Sue.
Thanks to NPR for sharing audio from their podcast, Microphone Check. And thanks to Pandora for sharing audio of Questlove Supreme.
Special thanks this episode to Ben Adair, whose initial guidance made the whole thing possible. We also want to show love to Prodigy's friends and family who gave us their time and shared their memories of a man they treasure.
WNYC's health coverage and the realness is supported in part by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Jane and Gerald Katcher and the Katcher Family Foundation, Science Sandbox, an initiative of the Simons Foundation, and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.